33:12. How many of you have memorized that so far? All right, let's get busy now. You've had 4 weeks. This is our key verse. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, and the people whom he hath chosen for his own inheritance. Now, bring you up to date, very briefly. Two groups, two nations, two nationalities attempted to settle what Columbus discovered. First of all, being the Spaniards. The Spaniards' rule of thumb was the rule of thumb of all of Europe at this point in time under the papacy, and that was, if you can't convert them, kill them. And again, I don't mean that as a cruel or an unkind statement, but simply as a statement in fact that all historical evidence will back up, and anyone who disagrees with that simply is ignorant of historical fact. I pointed out to you the fact that last week that by estimates of a university in Southern California, that somewhere between 70 and 105 million Indians were executed by the Spanish papists in a 100-year period of time. That's about 60 times more than Hitler killed. That's more than those people have ever hoped. I mean, they just wiped them out. Just wiped them out. And that was the rule of thumb. For some reason, the Spanish cannot move their colonization north into the main continent here of the United States. You find the French came. We talked about Champlain and those individuals that came the northern route and migrated down into what is Quebec, Toronto, and those areas along the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Great Lakes. They couldn't move south for some reason. They were held to the northern extremes of the North American continent. And then we talked about the 1595, the establishment of a colony at Roanoke, which is now in North Carolina, by really, to be honest with you, English aristocrats who had no concern for any work. They decided they wouldn't do any work, and that colony ceased to exist before 1588, 1590. The Spanish armada during this period of time is defeated. I hope you've got all this. I'm very briefly trying to skim through to where we are now. Spanish armada is defeated in 1588. Upon the return to the colony at Roanoke, it is discovered that it has been abandoned. No one knows to this day what happened to them, where they went. They simply ceased to exist. And so they're gone. And then you've got another group that comes and attempts to establish that same area, the colony at Jamestown. And this is where the aristocrats come. And the aristocrats come, refuse to work. They will not work. Let's see here. There is a tan Ford Escort, license number FQV721. Your lights are on. Don't worry about it. They won't be on by the time church is over. But if that is indeed yours, there's two or three more classes you probably need to hit. Okay? The English at Jamestown settle, and over the next period of several years, they literally are starved into oblivion. We talked about the problems that they had. They maintained that they were coming to this country to bring the gospel of Jesus Christ. But truth of the matter is that they bring one preacher with them. They refuse to go to services, and when they do, the services consist more of a fight as to who gets to sit in the particular rows, you know, because of the aristocracy who believed they had their own pew and the things like that. And there was never any evangelization of the Indians. As a matter of fact, they did some killing of their own. We can't lay all the blame at the feet of the Spanish. We can't lay all the blame at the feet of the French, although no one ever even could hold a candle to the Spanish for their methods of execution. John Smith, of whom history tells us much, was one of the fellows that loved to go killing Indians and was a formidable killer of the Indians in that area. The chief principal Indian name in that part of the country was Powhatan. Powhatan was a very, very patient man. And history will attest to that fact. From now until there is no more history, why Powhatan didn't wipe out the settlers at Jamestown is a miracle. If I had been Powhatan, I'd have had all their scalps hanging outside my tent, although I guess the French hadn't taught these Indians how to take scalps yet. By the way, it was the white man that taught the Indian how to scalp. It was the French, civilized, Christianized people from the continent of Europe, where they learned their torturous methods there. But Powhatan was very patient. John Smith went raiding several times, killed Powhatan's braves, stole their corn, took things away, even kidnapped his daughter Pocahontas at one time. And so the English were not above a little bit of devilment on their own. But God never blessed the colony at Jamestown. They could never get established. And although the colony later on begins to flourish, it was about this same time that the people we know as our forefathers, the Pilgrims, came to this nation and settled in a little place called Plymouth. We talked about that last week. Plymouth is right inside that bay up there. I don't know if you can even see that or not. Is that a little better? Right inside that bay there. And the Plymouth colony is founded by Pilgrims. Now, several weeks ago, I pointed out to you the difference between Pilgrims and Puritans, and I'll continue that this morning because we're going to look now at the founding of another colony, a colony that has been ridiculed. I'll be honest with you, as we go through here, you're going to find out that whatever present-day historians are ridiculing usually is a mark that it was used of God. Somebody told me the other night that they had just seen a documentary on public broadcasting concerning Washington and some of our fathers of our nation deriding them, ridiculing them, and making fun of them, talking about all their flaws and all their faults. Granted, I'm sure they have some, okay? But you're seeing now a change in the historical perspective of this nation toward its founders. And the reason is because the mark of Christianity is indelibly etched on the founding of this country. And they cannot get away with that Christianity or those Christian principles without ridiculing or mocking or making fun of our forefathers. I said last week, if Washington and Jefferson were alive today, you'd be in the middle of another revolution right now. There's no doubt in my mind. And you say, well, I don't believe that. Well, you need to read what they wrote, find out what they said, and then look at what you got. But at this time, back in old Merry England, remember there was a difference between the Puritans and the Pilgrims, okay? The Pilgrims were called separatists. And what had happened is that the taking of the throne of King James I in England, Puritans or the separatists as they existed were they were not appreciated. But under King James, the Puritan philosophy was tolerated. And so it was the separatists. Again, back in Henry VIII and Henry VII, problems with the papacy in Rome, and Henry VIII, of course, being famous for the break with Rome and establishing the Anglican Church. His establishment of the Anglican Church was in opposition to the Pope's refusal to allow him to divorce his wife. Now, what a reason to blow up a nation, you know, but he did it. Thank God that he did it, because he established the groundwork for Protestantism in England. He rejected the Pope, excommunicated him, he excommunicated the Pope, and they just had a wonderful time back and forth until Henry VIII declared that he was now head of the church in England. He never changed doctrine. He was Catholic through and through in his theology, but he did not allow or did not subscribe to the supremacy of the Pope. And because of that, he placed himself as head of the Church of England, and he allowed the people to continue to elect their own clergymen, or to at least have a say, although not freely and thoroughly. And the separatists believed that no one was to be head of the church save Jesus Christ. And so the separatists separated themselves from the Church of England. Now, you say, well, you know, good for them. That probably meant they had better sailing. But you need to recognize for a minute the fact that England was a church state. One of the greatest things that plagues the American consciousness is what it means to live in a church state. Because you never have. And because of that, you as an American are very naive in your thinking toward what a church state must be all about. But if you want to look at church states as they exist in the country, probably the most powerful church state that exists in this hemisphere is Mexico. The countries of Central America, you say, well, they have a problem with their natural resources. That's a lie. They have more natural resources, or as many as the United States has. I mean, do you think the Spanish people are more ignorant than white people? There aren't any racists here, are there? I mean, you don't think the Mexicans are less intelligent than we are, do you? Then why is their country so far behind our country? Say they've never had an opportunity. Why haven't they had an opportunity? You say, well, because their government never gave them an opportunity. Who controls the Spanish government? When you look at a church state, you're going to find that the church that's in control usually degrades that state to a serious, I mean more than serious, even less than that, a situation where they can't even function. I'll read you some of the quotes of Thomas Jefferson on Central America and what caused the problem in Mexico and Central America. Jefferson had a real insight into it. As a matter of fact, Jefferson said if he went in and liberated those people in Mexico from their church, it would take several generations before they'd ever learn to function. Thomas Jefferson said that. Wherever a church state exists, you'll find Europe is eaten up with it. Europe is eaten up with a church state system, so much so that when the Eccles family arrives in Italy, they're going to confront a situation where the church state exists. You say, well, boy, wouldn't it be wonderful where everybody belonged? About 98-99% of the Italian people do not attend church more than twice a year. And that's where the seat of their church is. They don't go. I heard more negative comments about the papacy while I was in Europe going on tours than I ever heard in America. I toured Salzburg, and I heard the story of how the archbishop penned himself up in the castle of Salzburg and watched people starve to death. And they were trying to kill the rascal, and he closed himself up in his fortress and wouldn't let them get in. I mean, they despise the papacy, and yet they exist under that system. Why? Part of their government. They can't separate anymore. And therefore, when you're born in Italy, you're automatically born into the church. Now, you have to go through confirmation and all that, but your national religion is that of the papacy. And all those countries believe in religious freedom, but they also believe you're not allowed to proselytize somebody from another religion. You want to see the danger in that? You've set up a church state, and automatically you can't witness to anybody. Because when they're born into a particular church. And if it's illegal to proselytize, it's illegal to try to talk to anybody about their church. So the church that's in control of the government controls the country, and no one else has a way to establish any type of foothold whatsoever. Brother Bailey talked to me last Sunday from Greece. I forgot to tell you last Sunday night, they had their first Greek fella ever saved in their services last Sunday in Greece. Walked the aisle, got on his knees, and got saved. That's illegal. You say, why? There's a church-state system in Greece. You say, well, what'll happen? Hopefully nothing. Nothing's going to happen to that fellow. He's going to heaven when he dies. But that's enough grounds for the government to enter in and close down that church and run the missionary out of the country. One fellow. Why? They can't stand the criticism. You know, if what you believe is right, you wouldn't think you'd get upset if people wanted to criticize it. Truth is truth. You can't hurt truth. No lie ever affected the truth for more than a few years until the truth was discovered about the lie. I mean, you can run around hollering, the sky is falling, all you want to. The truth eventually wins. So if what you believe is the truth, why are you worried about people criticizing it? Now then, back in England, King James dies in 1625. The great mark of his reign is the book you hold in your lap this morning, the King James Version of the Bible. And maybe, I'm not sure yet, maybe next week we'll go into the translation of that book just for a one Sunday brief visit to show you the remarkable nature that brought forth that book. As you study history at this point in time, you have got to begin to see the hand of God in all of this. 1492, the Spaniards start to work in the southern. Why don't they get up into this part of the country? You know, if you're sailing a ship from Spain, bringing supplies and goods, don't you know it'd be a whole lot easier to hit the east coast of this country than it would be to find one of them little islands? That's a navigator's nightmare to try and find an island down there in the midst of several hundred islands. And especially in the days when there wasn't Loran and Arnav and all that other kind of stuff. Why is it that they couldn't get up here? Why is it Ponce de Leon has run out? God put the most fierce tribe of Indians that could exist right here and right up here. New York and Florida. The two doors, the Spanish and the French, tried to come in. Down south, you've got the Seminoles. Brutal, brutal people. They were the only tribe of Indians never conquered by the white man. Tough birds. They got down there where them gators were. And them Spaniards couldn't catch them. Gators can handle that Spanish armor pretty well. Up here, you've got the nations of the Iroquois. The Iroquois hated the French. So much so that when the French and Indian War comes, all of the Indians in North America form an alliance with the French to get rid of the English. The French even fight a war here to get rid of the English who are now on the coast. All the tribes of Indians join up, link up with the French because they've been trading with them for years, except the Iroquois. And it was the Iroquois that had kept the French from getting down here on the coastline before. The Iroquois despised the Frenchmen. They fought with the English in the French and Indian War. And by the way, in case you weren't aware of it, the French and the Indians lost. The English and the Iroquois won. But God, you have to know that it was God. You take the two mightiest nations in continental Europe, Spain and France, and they can't establish a foothold on the coastline. Let me ask you a question. If you come into this nation up in St. Lawrence, Newfoundland, all that snow and ice, wouldn't you want it to move a little further south? Why do you suppose they didn't? They couldn't. They couldn't. And then here comes the English with dollar signs in their eyes. A new enterprise. And God won't let them get established. First at Roanoke and then at Jamestown. Why? Why is it that when the pilgrims get here, God begins to bless them? And they establish a foothold on this coast that nobody else is able to establish. It has to be God that's working. Now, at the same time God's working here, He's working in Europe. And I've talked to you how that I have yet to find a volume of church history, with the exception of maybe one, that deals with the impact of what went on in Europe with the settlement of this nation. Shortly after Columbus discovers America, you're dealing with the Reformation in Germany, Martin Luther, John Huss, all of those fellows who are rebelling. You're dealing with the Spanish Inquisition, which was a means to bring the Catholics back into the fold, but the Reformation had too deep-rooted itself, and they've got a war on their hand. Now you're dealing in Europe about the time the Spanish and the French are settling this country with counter-reformations. Where the papacy sending armies out to kill every Protestant that they can find throughout Europe. I don't find any historians dealing with any of that. Don't you imagine that has something to do with people wanting to come to this country? I mean, for instance, if they pass legislation tomorrow, and they may do it before it's all over with, and put a bounty on the heads of Bible-believing Protestants, don't you know if there was another country halfway around the world, I'd be willing to go and take my family rather than to risk torture and imprisonment here? Why don't the historians use that as maybe a means why people are willing to come to this country? The colony of the pilgrims we talked about last week. And we talked about how they came to this country and how they established the nation. In 1621, which was the year after they established their colony in 1620, in November, which was exactly a year, the first ship came from England. Now remember, the Mayflower had stayed with them. The Speedwell, which was the other ship, which was to have brought the pilgrims to America, could not come. So only one ship came. It was the Mayflower, the larger of the two. The pilgrims had established their colony there on the inside of that little peninsula, and they had named their place, so their colony, Plymouth Colony. They named it after the place they left from in England, which was Plymouth. The Mayflower stayed through the winter, and remember the terrible death toll for the pilgrims, much the same as it was in Jamestown. Out of 18 families, only three families were left intact. I think 13 of the wives, I guess it was, passed away, died in that first winter. There was a sickness that seemed to accompany every boatload of settlers that came to this country for years and years and years. And I don't know exactly what it was, whether it was rickets or scurvy or what it was, some of those ongoing diseases that tended to plague people in that day, smallpox, there was no cure. You were dealing with a very, very deadly situation when you came to this country. It wasn't like there was a hospital on every corner. There weren't hospitals. All they had was the medicine they brought with them, which most generally was consumed on the voyage itself over here. So they arrived at this country with no medicine, no hospitals, and many times no physician. And they relied on the Indians. The pilgrims established. We talked about them meeting Squanto and the other Indians that really saved their lives. These tribes of Indians. 1621, another ship arrives. It is the first ship that arrives from the time that they've been there. Remember, the Mayflower left in the spring. On board this ship, 35 more colonists are to arrive here at the Plymouth Colony. Among them is Thomas Cushman. We'll talk about him in just a moment, who was one of the original pilgrims that sought to come and was left in England for a specific purpose. But when they arrive, 35 more colonists, the colonists that live there are dismayed to find out they don't bring any tools. They didn't bring any new clothing. They didn't bring any supplies whatsoever. They didn't bring any food. So there are 35 more mouths to feed in the Plymouth Colony. Now remember, they'd had an abundant harvest the year before. But as they began to look at what they had to get through another winter and the 35 more mouths that they were going to have to feed, the Governor Bradford and the others who were in charge of the colony immediately decided they would have to be on half rations or they would starve to death. So they immediately went on half rations. Now on this voyage was Thomas Cushman. I mentioned Thomas Cushman because I wanted you to understand the background behind the pilgrims coming to this country. You didn't just pull up stakes and get a boat and go halfway around the country. It costs a lot of money to make those voyages. Matter of fact, probably cost as much to make those voyages by their standards as it does for you and I to make those voyages by our standards. You can pay up to $1,100, $1,200 for an airplane ticket. If you figure you're going to be taking not just an 8 or 9 hour plane flight, but a 72-day voyage, it's going to take a lot of food. A very expensive venture. And when the pilgrims had decided, the separatists had decided to leave Leiden in the Netherlands, they had contracted with then the Virginia Company. The Virginia Company was nigh into bankruptcy. They gave them a charter. They gave them a right to come and settle, but nothing more. They couldn't do. The Virginia Company had backed expeditions financially. They could not do that. And so the pilgrims had come up with a fellow by the name of Thomas Weston in England. Thomas Weston was a wealthy English businessman. And he had put together recently a group of individuals who were kind of entrepreneurs. They financed things in an attempt to make some money. And Weston agreed to take care of the pilgrims and to get them there. And their agreement was this. He offered them one share in this new colony for each adult 16 years of age and up. In return, they were to give him 7 years indenture. What that meant was they were to literally be sharecroppers. They were to farm and they were to raise crops and whatever it was, whatever business venture they involved themselves in for 7 years, Thomas Weston was to reap the fruits of all their labors. And that was in payment for his paying transportation and outfitting them and all of that type of work. You see, he didn't just come for free. And so they agreed to that, and the idea was that if you wanted extra shares, you could buy them. Some of the pilgrims had a little bit of money. They sold their homes and things like that in Holland, and you could buy some extra shares, but it was one share for each adult, 16 years of age and up, in exchange for 7 years of indenture. We don't believe in slavery. Your forefathers were all basically slaves. And the planters, in exchange for their work here, were given 2 days a week for themselves. At the end of the 7 years, they were to divide all lands by shares. In other words, if you had 2 out of 100 shares, you received 2/100ths of all the land. And they were to divide by shares with the idea that all gardens and homes that had been built on the property by the planters would remain the property of the planters. In other words, the homes belonged to the people that built them. Everything was to be exchanged. And that was the agreement that the pilgrims arrived at. Now, Thomas Cushman was one of the fellows that put that into operation. Thomas Cushman was one of their own number, but Thomas Cushman was allured by the sights of London. Remember, one of the reasons for their leaving Holland was the fact that the world was having such an effect on their children. It would be wonderful if the world could only affect children. But the world can have an effect on adults as well. And Thomas Cushman, he got the lights of London in his eyes. He kind of enjoyed the prestige of dealing with these wealthy businessmen, and he kind of put it in the minds of the pilgrims that I'll be your liaison here. And so when the Mayflower headed for America, Cushman stayed in London as the liaison for the pilgrims and the firm of Weston, who literally was in control. Just before they set sail, Cushman had, without telling anybody, changed some of the provisions of the agreement that they had made. And didn't tell them because Weston and he felt it would be better to wait till just before they sailed, when all their money was gone, to tell them what had happened. And to tell them, here are the changes. They would not agree to the changes. And there was a great argument over what was going to be done, and they went ahead and left. But they promised this before they left. Quote, if large profits should not arise within 7 years, we will continue together longer with you if the Lord will, end quote. That was to be their undoing. Because what they had in essence done is opened the door to a perpetual indenture. Not 7 years, but as long as Weston and those that ruled his company sought to keep them under indenture. They arrive in the United States. They didn't plant any crops. They arrived in November, remember? There weren't any crops to be planted. They weathered through the winter, the majority of them sick, many of them dying. It was all they could do to erect a few makeshift shelters in which they were to live. When the Mayflower returned to England, it returned empty. Weston was irate. And so he sent back Thomas Cushman with an ultimatum for the pilgrims, accusing them of being lazy, accusing them of not wanting to work, accusing them of spending all their time arguing rather than planning. And with an ultimatum, Cushman returns. And the leaders basically, by Cushman, who is really an expert salesman, are forced to capitulate to these demands made by Weston. Cushman reasons with them that if you fail to sign this new agreement with Weston, then you are in essence cutting yourself off from any supplies or any funding from England. You are literally on your own and you will die, which wasn't true, but the pilgrims were afraid. And so they signed the agreement. That agreement would take them 20 years to clear their debt. In that provision, they were charged interest rates sometimes in excess of 30 to 50%. As a matter of fact, their original debt was only 1,800 pounds British, and it took them 20,000 pounds to pay off that 1,800 pound note. The pilgrims were very much taken advantage of, and through the efforts of Cushman, they were forced to capitulate to this agreement, had to sign of it. It took them until 1,800 to retire that debt, actually before all things were closed and settled. In 1622, With additional mouths to feed and more houses to build, remember these other colonists had just arrived, you couldn't just get off the boat and say, well, let's buy a house. There wasn't any to buy. You got off the boat and had to find some family to move in with and to live with. And if you've ever seen a log cabin, have you ever been down Cape Cove and seen those log cabins? Just huge palatial mansions. As a matter of fact, they're probably not as big as this small little square area here of the platform. Sometimes maybe as big as a large master bedroom was the size of the whole cabin. Families, sometimes two and three families cooped up in one house in order to exist. And because of the additional workload of having to build some more houses for people to live in and the additional mouths to feed, by the winter of 1622, the Pilgrims were existing on a ration of 5 kernels of corn per day per individual. Now, what are you saying, preacher? I'm saying God's at work again, because there's no way you can live off 5 kernels of corn. But they did. They did. When they made it into the summer, or into the fall, excuse me, the spring, I'm trying to find the right season, of 1623, planting season again arrived. After coming through such a harsh winter, the prospect of going out to plant in the fields just didn't arouse much interest, obviously and rightfully so. You see, these people weren't farming for themselves. They were sharecroppers farming for someone that lived in England. There wasn't a lot of interest in doing the work, and William Bradford, who was governor of the colony, Miles Standish, who was in charge of defense, and some of the other leaders of the colony, got together and began to try and work on a solution. How in the world can we get our people interested in producing? The idea was this. I know what we'll do. We'll introduce capitalism. And capitalism was first introduced into this country by the Pilgrims in 1623 in the spring. And the ruling was this. If you will assist in planting of the crop that must be planted for our legal responsibilities first, we will take remaining lands and parcel them off so that each family has its own parcel. And all of the crop or all of the grain that comes from that parcel belongs to that individual that took care of that parcel. The results were that it produced an astounding interest in planting. Everybody wanted to work for themselves. Much is said about capitalism and how terrible and how bad it is, so much so that we've believed it, and so much so that communism is alive and well in Washington, D.C. today. This nation is more of a communist nation than it is a capitalist nation today. And if we get health care, it'll be 100% communist nation, just like Russia. But those people wanted to make their own way. They weren't looking for a handout from England. They weren't looking for somebody to send supplies and ships. They said, hey, you keep your stuff. Just let us make it on our own. They didn't want welfare. They didn't want Social Security. All they wanted was a right to make it on their own, which meant they had the prospect of failing on their own, too. And when the capitalistic system was first introduced, they went crazy. And they began to plant, began to care for their own parcels, as well as the parcel they had planted to carry out their legal requirements. In 1623, with the planting work all done, each of them has a right to a second planting for themselves. Everyone is enthused. They plant more corn than has ever been planted before. So much so they get overboard with it. Now, there's a danger in capitalism, and that is it's twofold, power and greed. I'm not saying capitalism is without its faults. But the problem with communism and socialism is, look around the world and you'll see what the problem with communism and socialism is, and watch America in the next 10 years and you'll see it happen all over again right here. And that is the loss of liberty and the control of the government. But socialism has failed everywhere it's ever been attempted. Communism has never worked other than on a piece of paper. And these pilgrims had, in essence, attempted a communistic-type rule because they were all working for the goal of one person and they were all taking according to their need. They were all contributing. It didn't work. When capitalism is introduced, they begin to work. But greed arises among them, and so God is at work. Remember, God kept the Spanish out. God kept the French out. God kept the English from getting established until the pilgrims could arrive. And he's not going to let the pilgrims be destroyed by this new concept, which is going to one day build the greatest nation on the face of the earth called capitalism. He's not going to let capitalism ruin these pilgrims. They get all their crops planted. They work hard. They labor to get those crops in the ground. Guess what God does? He stopped the rain. For 12 weeks, rain does not come. The Indians come into the pilgrims' village or in the town and say, "We've never had anything like this before. We don't understand what's going on. We've never had it so dry before. What is the reason behind this?" The Indians are doing their rain dances and appealing to their gods, and nothing is happening. There is no rain. 12 weeks, other than maybe a spattering here and there. The statement is made that the ground springs up with these plants, and the ears of, or the stalks of corn are not even 2 or 3 feet high before they prematurely bring forth the ears and rot. Withering. Nothing can be done. The pilgrims begin to realize that maybe there's something they've done wrong. That's one of the advantages of being one of God's people, is you eventually can get back to the source of the problem. It may take a while, but eventually we get to the source of the problem. And the pilgrims begin to think, maybe we've done something wrong and God is withholding his blessings from us. It said here that this is Winslow who is recorded making this statement, quote, "These and the like considerations moved not only every good man privately to enter into examination with his own estate between God and his conscience, and so to humiliation before him, but also to humble ourselves together before the Lord by fasting and prayer to that end. A day was appointed by public authority and set apart from all other employments." In other words, the pilgrims and their leaders called the day of public prayer and fasting. The last time you heard America doing anything like that? I guess they called for it a couple times, but when's the last time you saw it happen? A day of public prayer and fasting, and so no work was to be done. Everybody got a day off. Nobody went into the fields, and they carried out what they were to do. Matter of fact, Winslow goes on and says, "But oh, the mercy of our God, who was as ready to hear as we were to ask. For though in the morning when we assembled together, the heavens were as clear and the drought as likely to continue as it ever was, yet our exercise continuing some 8 or 9 hours." The last time we went to church for 8 or 9 hours. "Yet before our departure, the weather was overcast. The clouds gathered on all sides. On the next morning, distilled such soft, sweet, and moderate showers of rain, continuing some 14 days, and mixed with such a seasonable weather as it was hard to say whether our withered corn or drooping affections were most quickened or revived. Such was the bounty and goodness of our God." Rains for 14 days off and on, mixed, I guess, with what they would call beautiful weather. The crops are revived in the fields, and one more important thing is noted, and that is that the Indians marvel at the God of the pilgrims. The Indians make statements that even when we were able to get the gods to answer with our rain dances, and our they came with thunder and lightning and oftentimes would beat the crops on into the ground. But they said, "Your God sent the gentle rain that revived the corn," and the Indians stand amazed at the God of the pilgrims. What are you saying, preacher? God is at work. If you can't say anything else about the founding of this country, you have to admit that God was at work when this country was established. Mr. Atheist, God may be dead now, but you sure can't say he was dead in 1620. In your thinking, maybe there is no God, but there was a God in 1620 because he was at work. And these pilgrims saw him at work. The crop comes in with a greater abundance than they've ever had. Remember, there are two plantings that have been done now. Two crops come in. pilgrims have enough to trade and to trade with other Indians even that have had a bad year. They traded for tools because now they had the abundance of corn. Before, they'd been trading with the Indians, and they'd been trading their goods and their tools to get corn to live off of. Now the pilgrims have enough corn, and the Indians have suffered, and they can trade their corn now for some of the tools that the Indians can provide. And God enables them to do that. When the Thanksgiving season arrives, again, Bradford calls for another time of Thanksgiving. At this Thanksgiving, Bradford is married. Remember, most of those men had lost their wives. Bradford is married again. So this is a combination Thanksgiving marriage ceremony. They invite Massasoit, the Indian chief, hoping again that he would understand that he was invited. And he does understand that, but he also brings 120 braves with him again and shows up on the place. It says here, "And now to say somewhat of the great cheer we had at the governor's marriage, we had about 20 tasty venison, beside other pieces of roasted venison, and other such good cheer in such quantities that I wish you some of our share. For here we have the best grapes that ever you saw, and the biggest and diverse sorts of plums and nuts, 6 goats, about 50 hogs and pigs, also diverse hens. A better country was never seen or heard of, for here are a multitude of God's blessings." End quote. That's the way they felt about their country. You see, God had blessed. Back in England, things are evolving. King James is getting old. As a matter of fact, in 1625, King James dies. Charles I comes to the throne. And as I've said before, while the separatists were persecuted and expelled from the country, the Puritans were tolerated under King James, because the Puritan philosophy was that we can exist inside this church. We'll try to reform it from the inside. We'll try to change the problems that are here from the inside. We're not going to leave the church. We're not going to forsake the church. We're going to stay true to the church. And the separatists said, not us, we're leaving. So the separatists are expelled. The Puritans are tolerated. When Charles I comes to the throne in England, he appoints William Laud as Bishop of London. That is the most powerful seat you can hold in the English Empire at this time. In 1628, Laud becomes the Bishop of London. The first thing that he does is he presents a king with a list of all the clergymen in England so that he might know who could fill the offices and such things. Only Laud has done one other thing for the king. He has, behind each name, placed a letter, either the letter O or the letter P. O standing for Orthodox, P standing for Puritan, indicating that Charles should not nominate those that are Puritans, and rightfully he does not do so. He appoints the Orthodox Church of England, High Anglican men to those offices. And for the first time, the Puritans begin to see the handwriting on the wall, because now they become the object of ridicule. So much so that what is begun under Laud and King Charles is called the Great Migration. You see, God has established a tiny little foothold here on the coast of this country. But with less than several hundred settlers, it's not going to long withstand and build a great nation. There must be others to come. And so God now begins to stir up the nest as the eagle does, and he makes it a little more uncomfortable for the Puritans. Remember, they wanted to stay. And so the Puritans, because of the nomination of Laud to the position of the Bishop of London and his subsequent persecution against them, in the next 16 years, there are 20,000 Puritans that come to New England. There are 45,000 that come to come down to Virginia and the West Indies. 65,000 people. You say, well, it's not that many people. Well, considering the population of England in that day, it would be somewhere around, if in America today, 3 or 4 million Americans left at one time. That's about what it'd be like. So it was a good part, a sizable part of the English population. In 1628, John Endicott lands at a place that eventually would be called Salem, Massachusetts, and establishes the first Puritan colony in this nation. He brings 66 men with him. In 1629, Higginson brings 200 more men with him and establishes or helps reestablish that colony or reaffirm up that colony. Now let me say this, the one thing that helped the Puritan settlement in this country was one of the first things that Charles did when he came to the throne. Of course, England is controlled by a parliament who passes the laws, and the king really is the monarch and rules the country, but all the legislation passed through the hands of the king. The Puritans, seeing the handwriting on the wall, realizing what was coming, took the defunct New England Company. In other words, the New England Company, we talked about the Virginia Company, which went bankrupt. There was a New England Company, and it also had gone bankrupt. Really, it was hard to get people to come and settle here because people died by the scores. The New England Company had gone defunct, and the Puritans got an idea. And so they reorganized the bankrupt New England Company into what was called the Massachusetts Bay Company. And they placed their charter before King Charles I, organizing this Massachusetts Bay Colony to care for the settlement of the New World. And they put together this big charter, and I read to you some excerpts from the charters last week from Virginia, passed it through, it passed through the parliament, and King Charles signed it and got it out of it and forgot all about it. But the one stroke of genius in all of that was in the organization of the Massachusetts colony. They did not list where the meetings of the Massachusetts company were to be held. And in essence, what they did was open a door to move the whole company to New England. And that's in essence where you establish your first form of American government, was the Massachusetts Bay Company, which became the Massachusetts Bay Colony in America. Charles is a real power-hungry fellow. Not realizing what he's done, you can see in subsequent events how hungry he was. In 1628, he dissolved Parliament and said he'd run the country himself. And poured over every piece of legislation to protect his own sovereign rights. But a few years before, just before he dissolved Parliament, this Massachusetts Bay organization came through and passed without his notice, giving, in essence, the Puritans an open door, not to break with England, but to move to America. Their thought was this: we don't want to break from England. We don't want to leave the church. But if we can get far enough away and control our own affairs, we can exist and still remain loyal to the English crown. You see, that was not the mentality of the pilgrims who had come, but that was the mentality of the Puritans that were to follow. Let me read a quote to you here, if I can find it very quickly. When they were leaving, okay, here is a statement made by Francis Higginson. And again, Higginson comes in 1629, the year after John Endicott has arrived. Higginson comes, brings 200 more settlers with him. That's right after Charles has dissolved Parliament. And Higginson says this as they're leaving: we will not say, as the separatists were wont to say at their leaving of England, farewell Rome or farewell Babylon. But we will say, farewell dear England, farewell the Church of God in England and all the Christian friends there. We do not go to New England as separatists from the Church of England, though we cannot but separate from the corruptions in it. But we go to practice the positive part of church reformation and propagate the gospel in America. So you see the difference in the mentality of the Puritans and the pilgrims. The Puritans just wanted to come to America and right what was wrong with the Church of England. The pilgrims wanted to come to America and break with the Church of England. You say, why is that important? Because those two thoughts are going to meld together to give you what you have in America. As we'll see. Maybe this week, probably not. Higginson comes in 1629. John Winthrop comes in 1630. John Winthrop is going to be one of the greatest names in American history. You probably don't know it because it's not taught very much. But John Winthrop was the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. When Winthrop arrives in 1630, he finds that of all the colonists, some 266 plus individuals that have arrived before, only 85 of them are remaining. 80 of the original settlers are dead, and the rest of them have packed up to go back to England and are either gone or are leaving. There are 85 that remain. When he arrives, he immediately goes to work on what's wrong and why. Now, let me digress just a little bit and tell you some things that are going on in England. I have used extensively while we're studying here a book called The Light in the Glory, written by Peter Marshall, who I believe is a past chaplain in the United States Senate or Congress. I would recommend it for everybody. It's excellent reading. As a matter of fact, we're going to get some for our bookstore if you'd like to have a copy. And a great majority of what I'm teaching, I've used him as a basic source and filled in around his statements. But he says these things concerning England in the days. Remember, the Puritans are people that are very much opposed to sin. They are what we would call today conservative, reactionary, Bible-believing Christians. And here's what they faced in London. He says that was gay, colorful, lusty, brimming with all the drama of the Elizabethan age. Says that's the picture that everybody wants you to see. But underneath all that was the filth and degradation of London. As a matter of fact, a well-perfumed handkerchief was more a piece of survival equipment than a mannered affection. You always see the people with the perfumed handkerchiefs and you think of the aristocracy. That was so you didn't have to smell the stench of the city. Says London was not the sort of place you would want to take your child for a walk, even in the morning. For you would have to walk warily to avoid drunkards and tosspots reeling and brawling in the narrow streets. The taverns did a roaring business around the clock, being the main source of public entertainment, especially if one were not in the mood for a hanging or a play, or watching dogs bait a bear or pull a screaming ape apart. Running the taverns a close second were the trollops that hung out of the windows overhead, displaying their wares and pouring out a stream of commentary on all who passed below. Cut purses abounded in the teeming streets as pickpockets. Though robbery was a hanging crime, life had become so meaningless that it was worth risking just to steal money enough for a few days' oblivion in a grog shop. No wonder there were 137 capital offenses on the statute books. There had to be to maintain even a semblance of law and order. England's in a mess. England is a mess. England had reached that place from which it would never recover. You see, God had blessed England. God had prospered England. And England had forsaken the God that had prospered her. God had given England His word, and England had turned their back on the God that had given them His word. England was not a place where you want to live. That was conducive to people wanting to come to this country. The fact that the Puritans came under the persecution of the state system made them more willing to come. What were the Puritans like? Let me tell you a little bit about John Winthrop to get an idea of what kind of people these people were. Find my notes here. And I can't. Well, I'll read you part of what he said. He said, it would be a service. That's not what I want to read. I can't find what. Here it is. Thank you, Lord. I needed that. Found it. I desire to make it one of my chief petitions to have that grace and to be poor in spirit. I will ever walk humbly before my God and meekly, mildly, and gently towards all men. I do resolve first to give myself, my life, my wits, my health, my wealth, to the service of my God and Savior, who, by giving Himself for me and to me, deserves whatsoever I am or can be, to be at His commandment and for His glory. That was the idea of John Winthrop. He wrote that when he was 24 years of age. Winthrop loved the Lord, as most of these Puritans did. He also said in 1616, O Lord, Thou assurest my heart that I am a right... that I am in a right course, even the narrow way that leads to heaven. Thou tellest me, and all experience tells me, that in this way there is the least company, and that those who do walk openly in this way shall be despised, pointed at, hated by the world, made a byword, reviled, slandered, rebuked, made a gazing stock, called Puritans, nice fools, hypocrites, harebrained fellows, rash, indiscreet, vainglorious, and all that naught is. Yet teach me, O Lord, to put my trust in thee. Then shall I be like Mount Zion that cannot be moved. Now that was the thought processes of the men that came. Winthrop was the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Deep-seated love and devotion to the Lord Jesus Christ. When Winthrop comes, as I said before, he finds the situation deplorable. But when he comes, he finds from Endicott some things that have transpired that would forever form the beliefs of this colony, and we have to quit this morning, so you'll have to wait till next week to get them. When he arrives, Endicott has had some dealings with the pilgrims. And Endicott has changed some of his views to match some of those of the pilgrims, forming a mesh between the two theologies. And you're going to find that when the Plymouth, or when the Massachusetts Bay Colony is established, it is not established on Anglican order. And I'll explain that to you next week. We'll get on with it then. All right, take a break.